Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hello friends and welcome to Hello Friend. My name is Bethany Rutter, but before we begin today's episode, I would just like to draw your attention to a special episode that went up between the last regular episode and this one. In the special episode, I talked to four of the Bailey's Prize shortlist, Linda Grant, Madeline Thien, Ayobami Adebayo and Naomi Alderman. Linda talks about the real person behind the idea for her brilliant novel, The Dark Circle. Madeline discusses the cultural trauma behind Do Not Say We Have Nothing. Ayobami Adebayo gives a shout out to some Nigerian authors you might love. And Naomi Alderman tells me why she couldn't have written The Power without a catastrophic breakup. But anyway, back to today's episode. Today's friend is Jules Walker. She's a multi-talented joy across all platforms, and I love following her work. That's in spite of the fact that her greatest passion also happens to be one of my greatest fears, cycling. But we'll get on to that. First, how do we know each other?
We know each other through Twitter and social media, but this is actually the first time that we're meeting each other in real life. And I must admit that I'm having a fangirl moment about it.
And we've really followed each other for a very long time.
It's been years. It's been absolutely years, but our paths just haven't crossed until now. So,
and I've always sort of thought of you very warmly, and I remember a time when, like, I think you maybe had an accident or something bad happened to you, and I was like, I'm like, I hope she's okay, like, this does concern me, even Thank though I don't you. Know this person. I was like, this really, you know, this person I've never met, that's the power of the internet, like,
Thank
you do feel like you know people.
Thank you so much.
So tell me about your life in cycling. Just give me like the Jules edited version.
Well, hopefully I won't waffle on too much, but I've been back on a bike for 7 years now. So I started cycling again in March 2010, and that's when I started up my blog, Velo City Girl, as well. And I stopped cycling when I was 18 years old. It was that classic thing that seems to happen to lots of teenage girls, that it's not cool anymore, or, you know, none of your other girlfriends are doing it. And there was the mix of not feeling that confident about being on the road. So I just stopped. And it was one of my biggest passions in my life when I was a kid. And it was kind of sad that just at 18, I convinced myself that I didn't need to be on a bike anymore. And then 10 years later at 28, I was just like, right, I need to do this again. So I got back on my bike.
And that was when the blog started.
That's when the blog started.
I took a 10-year break from cycling. 10-year break. You got back on it and you were like, no, this is what I'm passionate about. And
yeah.
I'm going to start creating content.
This is just it. I mean, I say this and I often think, oh God, it probably gets really tired people hearing me say this. But I didn't start the blog in the sense of turning it into everything that it's become now, because I've always been a bit of a journal keeper. So I was blogging before Velo City Girl. I've got a blog that's sort of hidden away on the internet that I started some time ago called The Black Barbie Experience.
That's like an amazing name.
I used to love doing it. It was I'm an old school blogger, and I locked it away many, many moons ago. And I've always said one day I'll just release it and just put it back out into the wild. But I'd been blogging for a long time. I'd been journal keeping. I've got like a box full of diaries that I kept, because I started diary keeping when I was about 9 or 10 years old. And I've kept all of them. And it's quite funny actually having a look back and looking at some of the crap that I used to write about. But it was an extension of that for me doing it. And it literally was a case of, I'm back on a bike and I want to share my journeys with people if anyone was interested in reading it.
That is such a great thing to do. And did you find that you had relatively instant success with the blog?
Well, yeah, I mean, it depends on what you define success to be, because there was a cycling sort of blogging community out there that existed that I didn't even realise that I was going to end up tapping into. And I think it was how welcoming that community was when they found the blog and were talking to me about it and encouraging me to go for it. It kind of blossomed from there. And it was just this sort of little cycling family that ended up happening that I still hold dear to this day. But the intention never was for it to be this sort of content monster that it kind of turned into.
The Jules Empire. Yeah. The Velo Empire.
I like that. I think I might have that.
I don't think it is unfair to say that the world of cycling is very male and mm-hmm. very white.
Yes.
How have you navigated that as a black lady?
Well, I kind of tried to make my own path with it. I mean, another one of the reasons why I started up Velo City Girl was because of the fact that obviously I wanted to get back into cycling. But at the same time, within mainstream cycling media, marketing, advertising, I wasn't seeing anybody that looked like me. I wasn't seeing anybody that I felt was representative of me. I wasn't seeing anyone that I could identify with as well. And I thought to myself, well, I'm going to put myself out there and do it, because there's the stereotype that goes with cycling that it's all about mammals, middle-aged men in Lycra, and they're all white and they're all middle class. And that's not the case. Is within cycling culture, you'll see it, that it's so wide and varied, but at the same time, it's not being talked about enough. That's how it felt to me anyway.
That these people exist, but yeah, they're not being represented.
No.
Their stories are not being told.
We're out there. We're definitely out there. It's not, you know, whatever preconception that you have of what a cyclist is, or even that word itself, cyclist, feels like it can be quite loaded and heavy. There's so much more going on to that, but it just doesn't feel like it's had a light shined on it enough. So that's something that I ended up doing with Velo City Girl, and I'm very proud to still be doing to this day as well.
Yeah. No, that's like genuinely a very cool and probably quite difficult thing to feel like kind of a lone voice in a world.
It can be hard. And it was something that I talked about quite recently, because I did a talk at the Women in Cycling conference that happened in Bradford. And it was that kind of visibility that I was talking about, and how hard it is when you feel like you're the only one. And if you want to encourage other, you know, women of colour or people of colour who are cycling to talk about it, it's that whole thing again about the representation and seeing someone you can identify with. But when you feel like you're the only one, you almost feel like, well, I don't want to say anything. I kind of feel like I don't have that support unit or other people around me. So it can be quite scary. And I still have my moments where I have moments of fear speaking out about stuff. But I've said this to someone before, I'd be more frightened if I didn't say anything and wonder what the repercussions of just keeping quiet.
Yeah, no, it's a really like valuable asset, not just for yourself, like creating like a career and a reputation, but like you're creating genuinely useful content for people that probably can't get it anywhere else.
Well, I hope that people enjoy it. I mean, I still refer to it as my little corner of the internet. I still think of it as just my little place that I go and do some writing, and then I get on my soapbox when I go and do some public speaking and what have you. And then having worked within the cycling industry as well, it was something that I saw wasn't being reflected, and that was hard. That was actually really hard, to be working in my dream but then not seeing enough women like me or women like me being represented. So it was tough sometimes. It was,
but everything you do like career-wise now, that's pretty much like post blog, isn't it? Like that's based on your blog.
It was all based on the blog, because before I was working within the cycling industry and doing what I do now freelance, I was working for the University of East London. So I was working in their admissions office for about 7 years I was there for. And that was around about the time towards the tail end of that I started up the blog. I got offered the job that I had at the cycling clothing company that I worked for because of the blog. And that's kind of the thing that kick-started all of the changes that happened. But even though I was working within the cycling industry, I still felt like I wasn't able to do the things that I really wanted to do. There were elements of it that felt restrictive. And last year, I made the leap and decided to go completely freelance with it, so I could concentrate on doing Velo City Girl, doing TV presenting, going and doing public speaking. That and the fact that having a stroke also made me think twice about what it was that I wanted to be doing in life, and I had to focus on what mattered to me. And even if it made me sound like I was being a bit selfish, I was just like, well, no, something happened that could have killed me.
No, I don't think you need to worry about sounding selfish when you're literally like, I've had a stroke, what do I want to do now?
Yeah, I think I want to do me. I actually, you know, I just thought, why not? I want to do me. No one else is going to do it. And if I keep on putting stuff on the back burner.
Yeah, and treating your passion as like a side project rather than like saying to myself, like, no, I really think I can like turn this into my whole thing.
Do it. And it's been hard. There are still times where, you know, I thought to myself, oh my God, I've made a terrible mistake, like trying to do this freelance and making it work. But, you know, touch wood, I've not died. I'm still enjoying what I'm doing. I'm making it work. And a year later, a lot of stuff has happened within that 12 months or so, which is exciting and scary at the same time that it's going on. But I've done it. It's just, it's the sense that, you know, it's not complete. I'm still on the journey. But I do think to myself, if I didn't take that leap a year ago, what would I be doing now? And as sick as it might sound, if I didn't have that stroke, I probably wouldn't have changed my way of life and what I was doing. You know, for me, one of the things that hit me, because I care for my mum, I'm my mum's carer as well. And I think the thing that knocked me sideways and made me cry is when my mum said to me, I don't want to be burying you. And I was just like, oh, no. My mum saying that is just like, I need to stop and think about this. But I was just like, right, okay. I think about what I was doing with the 9 to 5 or the 9 to 6 or sometimes 9 until 11:45 at night if I was still in the office working away. And you're churning away at it because it feels like it's what you're supposed to do. There's the working culture that goes with the elements of, you know, I wasn't doing it for brownie points or overtime or anything like that. I was doing my job and getting it done because that's because you're supposed to do it. That's how I was looking at it. And it's just like, I'm not looking at the things that are actually making me happy, the things that I enjoy. Working in the cycling industry and actually losing sight of the fact that this was my passion and it now just starts to feel like a chore isn't a good place to be. You don't want to start resenting something that's supposed to bring you so much happiness. But I admit I had my own issues with a work-life balance and I needed to address that. And getting seriously ill seemed to be the thing that gave me the kick up the arse to do it. I don't recommend having a stroke to anybody, by the way.
That's not career advice.
Yeah, that's definitely not career advice to do that. But it took something like that happening for me to think twice. But, you know, it's the worry of either material things that you're thinking about that you have when you're working. You know, a hell of a lot of rebudgeting and all sorts of things with my money had to be sorted out and scrambled in my head in that sense. But it's like, if I can do this and I can forsake certain things that I really don't need or have to have, then I will survive.
So what do you fill your days with now? You're living the freelance life. Yes. What do you do on a daily basis? Well, not necessarily a daily basis, but like what fills your time?
My blog fills up a hell of a lot of my time now that I actually have the time to concentrate on it as well, which is cool. Being able to go and do events like the talk that I did at Bradford, actually having the time to do that and that being scheduled in, because I always feel like I sound like a bit of a wanker when I say this, but I have a media agent that looks after my timetable and my schedule for me as well. And it's at that point where it's that busy that I've actually got an agent who's sorting out work for me and sorting out my scheduling for me. So I had that fear that when I went freelance, I was just like, I'm going to have absolutely nothing to do.
No one knows who I am. No one cares about me. No one's going to give me any money.
Yeah. And it's just like, it didn't end up going that way. I had things that were filling my time. And then I did some freelance work for another cycling clothing company recently as well, which was great because it almost sounds like a silly thing to say, but it's that idea that I've worked within a company for, you know, I was at that company for about 4 years or so. I picked up so many skills through doing operations, sales and marketing, customer service. And then for another company to actually go, hi, we'd actually like to employ you to do some freelance work with us, was just like, oh, I have actually got some knowledge that somebody wants. Someone's interested.
Because I feel like imposter syndrome is such a thing. I'm like, you're so knowledgeable. Like, your whole life revolves around cycling. And yet, clearly, there's still a part of you that's like, what I have to offer the world is not really that valuable.
I feel like that every day. Every day,
like you're getting
Bethany,
away
I'm
with
not,
it. Well, like somehow you're like sneaking under the radar.
This is just it. I suffer from imposter syndrome badly. And I've talked about this. Like, I did a blog post today where I talked about having imposter syndrome, and then when I gave a talk at the Broken Spoke Co-op, an adventure syndicate women's cycling festival that happened a few months ago, I honestly thought to myself, because Emily Chappell, who I absolutely adore on the cycling scene, and Lee Craigie, who were the founders of the adventure syndicate, invited me to come and speak on the panel, and my first thought was, why do you want me? It sounds weird. Yeah, it's just like, why do you want me? Like, I looked at the rota of women that were going to be talking on the panel. I get this every single time I ask to do something. It's in the same way that I'm sat here with you and I'm like, why does Bethany want to talk to me? Like, seriously.
And I'm like, oh my God, I really want to talk to Jill. Like, she is so interesting. She has such a like interesting perspective on stuff. I'm going to learn so much from her.
Thank you.
But yeah, I guess we just never assume that anyone is thinking about us like that.
Yeah, and it's that culture that seems to exist of doing yourself down as well. I know there's that whole thing of like self-deprecating humor and blah, blah, blah. But I just, you know, it feels like it's so ingrained into you as well. And sometimes I feel that, I'll say sometimes as a black woman that I feel that as well, that I almost feel like I shouldn't be shouting from the rooftops about my achievements and what it is that I'm doing. And I'm just like, why am I not doing that? Why am I not?
The world isn't going to shout about your achievements for you.
No.
If you don't, no one will notice them.
That's just it. And I just think, well, I've got to get on my own soapbox and get, like, you know, my own foghorn out and talk about myself. But then at the same time, there is that feeling of, oh my God, why am I doing this? This isn't right. Or, you know, imposter syndrome. I've got no idea what I'm talking about. So, but yeah, that's why it lifts me up. And it means so much to me when I get the kind of support that I do from people that read the blog or follow me across my social media or asking me questions about cycling. And I'm just like, oh, okay, maybe I have something that I can impart some knowledge or some form of wisdom. It's nice to be able to have that kind of knowledge of people looking for it, because, you know, I'm still learning every day from so many amazing women that I meet within the cycling industry or just online, full stop, as well. There are so many things that I take from that. The talks and conferences that I went to recently, I was learning new things, and it's just like, oh, okay, I've got a great takeout from this. I've got great knowledge that I'm taking away from these amazing people that I've worked with or spent a day with. Stuff that I didn't know, I'm still learning about. And that's fantastic to know that there are women out there that have got that. And then to think someone else is thinking of you as a woman that's got that is just like, oh, okay.
And we can talk about this now because it was announced yesterday.
Yeah!
You are going to be imparting so much more knowledge to so many people because you have a book coming out.
I do indeed. I've got my first book coming out, and it's called Back in the Frame. And it's telling the story about how I got back into cycling as a 28-year-old. But it tells the story literally from being a kid to the point that I'm at now. And it's a mix of part memoir, part guide. So there will be some knowledge, and there will be some home truths going out there as well. But yeah, I've been working away on this since September last year, and I've had to keep my mouth quiet about it. A mix of not talking about it because I didn't want to jinx it, because I'm a very superstitious person, yeah, and the whole thing could have come to nothing. And a mix of the imposter syndrome thing creeping in as well. But yeah, hopefully there'll be some handy advice in there for anyone who is interested in cycling as well to get into it. But it's going to be quite an honest book. So
I cannot wait to read it.
Thank
I hope
you.
I can get a little signed copy.
Oh, of course.
And maybe, like, this is genuinely a book that I should read because, like, I'm very scared of cycling. Mm-hmm. Like, I will look out of the bus window and see people cycling and just be like, I cannot imagine ever doing that. Mm-hmm. Like, I can cycle. Like, my granddad taught me to cycle when I was little. Like, I cycled around Greenwich Park, but it's just like putting that onto the streets of London is intensely terrifying to me. Like, how do you get over that?
It can be scary. I'm not going to lie. That's something that I won't do and say that, you know, it's absolutely fine.
Nothing bad ever happens.
No, yeah. Bad things do happen, but bad things happen when you cross the road. Bad things happen when you get on the bus. Bad things happen when you step out of bed in the morning, you know. And for me, you know, like I said, I stopped cycling when I was 18 years old because I convinced myself that I didn't need to ride anymore. But there was a lot of fear that came in with that as well, that I didn't feel confident on the roads anymore. And, you know, when you're riding a bike as a kid, there's almost a real sort of carefree element that comes with it. So, you know, it'd be me and my mates riding around the council estate that I live on and still live on to this day, just riding around to the park or going to each other's houses or what have you. And it was just like, okay, simple as that. But then as I got older, I suddenly got much more aware of it. And I was just like, actually, I don't think this is for me. That's a mixture of my own fears, as I've said, looking at the infrastructure within London traffic as well and not feeling that comfortable or confident with it. So I stopped. But then, you know, it was that fear and that worry was the thing that was holding me back from something that I love doing. And that's why there was a 10-year hiatus. At 28, I decided to do it again. But I thought I made a mistake when I got the bike. I got the bike from a shop not too far from here. And I got it through the Cycle to Work scheme through my old employer, which was great because I couldn't have afforded it outright. And then when I got it from the shop and it was a case of riding from London Bridge back to Canning Town, I was just like, I can't do this. I just thought to myself, I had a voice in my head saying to me, I can't do this. My boyfriend had come with me as well. So I got the tube. He rode his bike to the bike shop and waited for me there. And the plan was we were just going to ride home together. We'd worked out the route. It was only going to take about 40 minutes or so to cycle from London Bridge back to East London. And I just panicked. I mean, I didn't have the greatest experience when I got the bike as well. It wasn't joyous, is the best way to put it. And that kind of knocked my confidence before I actually got out of the shop.
Was it a bad man?
It was a bad man. There was
a bad man treating you badly.
There was a bad man. And I think it's because I had questions. Even though I'd gone to the bike shop before because I had to hand in the voucher for the Cycle to Work scheme and what have you. And I got told when I come to collect the bike on the Sunday, there will be someone there to help me answer any questions and queries that I've got. And of course, that person didn't exist. The person that I was looking for wasn't there, not in the sense that person physically wasn't there. I had an idea in my head of who I was going to end up talking to and how knowledgeable it was going to be. And it just wasn't like that at all. And I felt like a bit of a dick when I was asking these questions, because I was made to feel like a dick, which is an experience that other women have told me over the years that they've had when they've gone into bike shops, that yep. It can be quite intimidating. And if it's at the point where you walk into the bike shop and you just feel like turning around and walking back out again, that's a problem.
Yeah, it's like saying, this is not a space for me.
Yeah.
Like, this is not a space that I should be in. I don't belong here. And that's so painful and off-putting.
And this is just it. This is one of the things that I try to champion with the blog and across social media, that there are places that exist for you to be able to go to and resources that are out there for women, like some fantastic, like independent and local bike shops that you can go to where you will feel comfortable in that environment. And again, even I getting back into cycling at that point, I wasn't aware of that, you know, I wasn't aware of those resources, those different types of shops or groups that are out there. And again, that's another preconception that seems to come with cycling. If that's the first impression you get of it, then that's what all cycling shops are like, or that's what the cycling environment is going to be like. From the point that I took the bike out of the shop, and even the measurements on the bike, I didn't feel comfortable. Like, the saddle felt like it wasn't at the right height. The handlebars didn't feel like it was the right height. I asked about that in the shop. I didn't get any help with it at all.
And surely that's easy shit.
Well, this is just
like entry level stuff.
It feels like it's just, I'm asking what seems like basic questions, but then to be treated quite basically at the end of it as well was just like, all right, okay, maybe I should know. And you know, I'm not ashamed to admit things, like I wasn't sure how to adjust the saddle or how to adjust the handlebars on the bike for it to be comfortable for me. And then, you know, it was that whole thing of, right, I've got to ride home now and we'll get this done in 40, 45 minutes and it will be fine. And I was just panicking. I was just absolutely panicking about it. And Ian had said to me, look, if you feel that bad, I will ride your bike home, come back on the train, get my bike and ride that home as well. And then that's it. We'll just get the bikes home and you get indoors. And he was so patient with me as well, which was exactly what I needed. And, you know, the other thing he said was like, well, we can just give it a try. And we found a quiet back street around London Bridge. And I was just riding up and down like a child. It sounds silly, but, you know, for me, that was a big deal to be able to just do that, just to build up and feel a bit more confident. And the 40, 45 minute ride home actually took 3 hours for us to get back, because I took my time.
And that was what you needed.
Yeah, it's exactly what I needed. I didn't want to be rushed. I didn't want to be pushed. And by the time, you know, that it got to the latter part of the ride, when I was like on Cable Street and getting near to home, everything just started to feel like it was clicking into place and it felt good. There were still the nerves, but I was just like, do you know what? I did it. I actually did it. I got it home. It took longer than expected, but I did it.
And you are sitting here today
Yes. With
TV appearances, book deal. A very successful vlog.
Yes. And the TV stuff and all of that, that was nice that happened.
Yeah, how did that come about?
It was, I was invited to be a guest on the Cycle show. So it was a show that was on ITV4 that started up four or five years ago. I watched the first episode. I really enjoyed it. And I tweeted out about it, basically just saying it was lovely to see like a magazine show like that about cycling on the telly. Because I was kind of expecting it to almost be like Top Gear for bikes, if that makes sense. And I was just like, oh, I hope it's not going to be something along those lines. And they contacted me through the tweet just saying, well, actually, if you enjoyed it so much, why don't you come and be a guest on the next episode? And I was just like, really?
Me
again, imposter syndrome creeping in and everything. And I was like, all right, okay. And I was basically invited to come down when they were filming at Look Mum No Hands and talk about cycling culture in London. And like, you know, just talking about my blog and stuff like that. And I got there and I'd never done anything on TV before. I was super nervous. Other reasons why I was super nervous about it, other than the fact it was the first time doing TV. Imposter syndrome, as I said, was creeping in. Got made to feel very comfortable on the sofa chatting. And I was like, okay, right, I've done my piece. That's great. Talked on the sofa. And then before I could like just get back into the audience and just sort of enjoy watching it, I got asked by one of the producers on there if I wouldn't mind doing a 5-minute segment. And I was just like, oh, what do you mean? And they're like, oh, we have a cycling group of the week. Every week we're going to bring somebody in. And there was a group of guys called the Near Naked Cyclists who were the cycling group of the week. They were dressed up in like all in one sort of body yep. suits. I want to call them morph suits for
yeah,
some
I was
reason.
Thinking about morph suits. Yeah. I think that's what it's called.
And it had strategically placed fig leaves on their person. And they were cycling to raise money for testicular cancer. And they needed somebody to interview them, to talk about what they were doing, you know, the reason behind their cause, how long their route and their rides were going to be. And they asked me if I wanted to do it. And I was like, okay. Had a look at some research questions in regards to what to talk to them about. Did it. And it went surprisingly well. And I was just like, again, done and dusted. That was an amazing day. Brilliant. Enjoyed it. Thanks for asking me to come and do it. And then I got contacted by the producers a few days after the show, like after that episode had gone out, just saying to me, oh, you actually went down really well with people. So do you actually want to come and do this with us on a regular basis and work with the show? And I was like, yeah, okay, definitely. Wasn't expecting that. And I don't know, maybe they were saying that I gave a sort of different angle and perspective on cycling that they wanted to have in the show as well. And I was just like, I'm going to do this.
I want to be that person.
Yeah, if it's going to be, again, the case of visibility and shining another light on other elements of cycling that people don't expect to see or think is out there, then I'm going to do this, even if it gives me the absolute fear of God and the anxiety just creeps over me every time I go to do something like this. Again, as I said, it would be more frightening not to do that.
And it's so interesting that like you'd done this work before, like you had appeared on TV, you had like given a really good like interview yourself, you had been able to interview other people, and you were still surprised when they were like, you did great work.
Yeah.
And it's because you probably didn't like identify as a TV presenter.
No, I mean, it wasn't a particularly traditional route for it to come in to do it. And there's that absolute fear that I'm going to have people sort of slagging me off at the same time saying, well, she doesn't deserve to be doing this, or she shouldn't be up there doing any of this stuff. And
why is that? Because you think that you don't know enough, or because like you're a woman or you're a black woman, or
it's a mixture of what you were saying. It's that whole thing of, well, you know, I don't, it's that whole thing of like, it's not a traditional cycling background that I come from. What is a traditional cycling background? That's what I should be asking myself. You know, anyone that wants to put their bum on a saddle,
yeah, exactly,
and ride,
yeah,
you're a cyclist, you're doing it. That's what's important. And it's just, you know, if I didn't come from it from some kind of old school background or perspective, it's just like, well, what am I doing here? And it's my own self-doubt as well. Like, I have huge issues with my own confidence. And I tell people about this, and sometimes I just get people like, oh, I don't believe you, or you're making it up and what have you. It's just like, no, I genuinely freak out about some of the stuff that I'm doing or some of the stuff that I get asked to do. You know, the person that gets to see it the most is Ian when he comes with me. Like,
is
if I go
at internet user Grobbler.
Yes, that's at internet user Grobbler, who's the boy on the blog, on, you know, the one that does all of the cooking and the cycling,
yeah,
and stuff with me.
Good lad.
So he's a top lad. He's definitely a
and he's
a top
been around
lad.
A while.
He has.
So, yeah.
Do you know
he's
what?
Put in the years.
He's put in the years, and you know, we have that whole internet connection thing going on, because in a completely different tangent, we met each other in the days of the internet when it was still a bit odd.
Oh my god, which internet did you meet on? Tell me about this. I
we,
love this stuff.
We met on a techno music forum called No Future.
Oh my god, you're so cool. You're so cool.
So yeah, it's another one of my things. It's like I have very eclectic taste in music, and techno music is one of my things that I quite enjoy. So this was a forum where you would be talking about artists like Jane Liddell, Christian Vogel, Super Collider, Aphex Twin, all sorts going on there. And I was on that forum. He was on that forum too. We got talking to each other, and we just got on there, which was great. And I don't know if it was supposed to be an intentional chat up line or what have you, but he was working in the games industry at the time, and he was working on a political game. I studied politics with law at university, and he asked me if he could meet up with me to borrow some of my politics books for something that he was working
on. That sounds like a lie.
And I was like, all right, okay, fine. But we ended up meeting at a music gig. We went to go and see Jamie Liddell at the, when it still existed, I don't know if it does anymore, the Metro Blow Up 100 on Oxford Street.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
No,
but
it was a...
Yeah, that could still exist.
I think it's still
it's
there.
It's hard to keep track of what exists
exactly.
in London anymore.
Exactly. But we ended up meeting at that gig for the first time, even though we'd been talking to each other on the forum for quite some time. And I remember like telling some of my friends and my mom as well that I was going to be meeting up with this guy that I was talking to on the internet, and it was just like.
So what? Wait, this must have you've been together a really long time.
We've been together for 13 years.
So that was actually like weird internet.
Yeah, weird internet.
This is not OKCupid.
No,
this is not Twitter. This
none
is
of
like,
that at all. Yeah. It was pre all of those things, and it was just that whole thing of, well, you're meeting a guy off the internet, like, you know, we need to know where you're meeting, you know, what does he look like, where are you going to be going to, blah blah blah. And I was just like, it's fine,
it's
like,
cool.
Yeah.
If he is a murderer, he's done a really good job
of
like, making himself
it.
Seem like a cool guy.
But you know, like, I was just like, okay, meeting this guy called Grobbelaar, and his avatar was a picture of Zippy with loads of Mr. Gold, like Mr. T gold chains on and what have you. And it's like, I'd seen pictures of him, so I knew what he was going to look like, but we just got on really well, and you know, things worked out, and 13 years later he's now the guy that does like about 99% of the photography that you see on the blog. He's well into his cycling as well, so we get to do these things together, and that's great. And you know, he was one of the biggest boosts for me to actually get back on my saddle as well, because you know, while we were together during that time, he used to ride loads. He would commute to work, he would go riding on the weekends and what have you, and I was just like, I actually want to be doing that with him.
Yeah, that's
I really
not just
do.
His thing.
Yeah.
Like, this could be my thing too, and this could be a thing we do together.
Yeah. And I told him about how I used to love getting on my bike when I was a kid and up into my teens and what have you, and it was that whole case of just talking to him about it, but not actually like going out there and getting a bike.
Yeah.
And it was just at that point where I was like, right, I'm actually going to do this.
What's the worst that can happen?
This is just it. I thought to myself, you know what, I try it. If I don't like it, then at least I gave it a go. And that's one of the ways that I have to look at life now after what happened last year with the illness. I've got to look at it as a sense of just give it a go. The worst thing that can happen is that I don't enjoy it and I never do it again. And I think that's the way that I have to look at so many things now. Otherwise, I will go insane.
Yeah. And you'll make like bad decisions, like decisions motivated of like fear of life,
yeah.
rather than like fear of death is kind of a pretty good motivator.
You know? And it's just it's having the fear standing in front of you and it getting in the way. So, you know, it was like the fear of doing this at the moment, the whole thing with the book, when, you know, Joe Bell, who's my literary agent from Bell Morton Lomax, are the people that are looking after me. They're lovely. I was just like, okay, like, you've approached me to want to do this. I've got ideas that I want to pitch to you. And there was the fear of, oh God, why am I doing this? Like, you know, no one's going to be interested in this. You know, it's that whole thing of, that's great that people enjoy reading the blog and seeing what I talk about on social media and what have you, but would anybody actually want to read what I've got to say? And you know, now that the news is out there, I was getting so many nice messages, and a friend of mine sent me a really nice message yesterday about it as well, just saying that it's just going to be such a refreshing change to have a book like this about cycling, or just as a woman in cycling, or a black woman in cycling as well, that's going to be completely different from some of the standard fare that ends up going out there. And you know, that's a huge encouragement for me. Like, you know, I don't know if some of the people that were sending me those messages yesterday and today have any idea of the impact that makes. It goes straight to my heart, and it really means a lot. Internet friends, I love you. But I really, really love you. And it's the idea that some people say, well, you know, friendships on the internet aren't real friendships and they're not real communities. Yes, they are, because for the last 7 years, you've genuinely saved my life. So, yeah, means a lot.
Big up the internet.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I've got so much from the internet. It's the best place in the whole world.
Mm.
And there are like people, yeah, like you, like I followed for years, and
yeah.
I don't even know how we would have
well this is just
it.
I'm wondering, because you know, I think of like sometimes I can pinpoint so many people that, you know, I've met on the internet, and I know what the thing is that's ended up bringing us together. And I think with you it was a mutual love of Tatti Devine.
Do you know what I've so I don't make I write down my intro that I'm going to read out at the beginning of each episode. Mm-hmm. And then I will write down a couple of bullet points of like things that I want to talk to the person about. I won't write out full questions, but I've written like five for Jaws. And one of them is just tatty. Full stop. Yeah. It's the best in the world.
Yeah.
So Jaws is wearing a very cute necklace today.
Thank you.
Like a multicolour acrylic circles.
Yes.
Little discs. Is that a tattoo?
It is indeed. It's Tatty Divine, and it's a collaboration they did with Tate. So it was their colour theory collaboration they did in 2012. And this was one of the colour theory necklaces that they did. So
it's very cute.
Thank you kindly.
Have you had to cut back on the tatty since going freelance?
Oh my God.
Was that one of the things that you were like, that's what has to go?
That was definitely one of the things, because I was just like, it was a regular, and it still is in certain ways a kind of regular habit. And now it's like a treat. But I've been an old school Tatty Divine fan for a long, long time. And I feel like a bit of like the old guard of Tatty Divine fans. But one of the things that I did, which is completely off tangent, but while being freelance, I had time to actually sort through my collection, which is something that I haven't done since I started collecting many, many years ago. And I created a separate Instagram account that's called Tatty Log.
God, that's so cool.
And I'm literally just, for me, it's actually like there's a story to every single piece of jewelry that I own. And it's just like, you know, actually listing it out, remembering the season that it came out, remembering when I bought it or the reason why I bought it.
Like,
yeah, you know, and it's just like every single piece has that significance. And for me, like one of the things, it sounds like I do nothing in freelance time, but I was able to actually start listing this stuff out, taking photos of it and listing an Instagram account for it, just so that I could like look at the pieces. And it actually reminds me, do some wardrobe remixing, because obviously one of my passions in regards to the blogging side of things was the cycle style, because I will call myself a cycle style blogger as well, because I just ride in my ordinary everyday clothes.
Yep.
And that's one of the things that I try to promote as well. And I like doing a bit of clothes shopping. I'm not gonna lie, I definitely enjoy it. But then I realise how much I've actually got and how wasteful it is sometimes to just keep on buying things and not actually looking at the fact that you have a shit ton of clothes, basically. And you're just like, you know.
But with your tatty Instagram, there is like a real tatty world on Instagram, isn't there?
Yes.
Like, almost as much as like the world of cycling on the internet. There's like the world of Tatty Divine on
the internet. There are some super fans out there, and I've met some of them and I know them, and they're great. How passionate they are about it is great. And then a good demonstration of that is the sample sale that happened
last weekend or 2 weekends
ago.
Two
weekends ago. I remember going to the very first sample sale that Tatty Divine had at the Brick Lane store, and it was small enough in the sense that it didn't matter what time of the day that you went, because you'd just be able to just walk in. Loads of stuff there to choose from as well. But the queue wasn't insane. And then as the years have gone on,
it's become more and more and more of a thing.
Yeah, it's like
a real thing.
Yeah, it's an event. You know, I'm sure there was a woman that traveled from Belgium for it for the one 2 weeks ago or something. And I was like, you know, there were people queuing up from 3 o'clock in the morning for the sale to open. I was like,
I'm thirsty for a bargain, but I'm not that thirsty.
It's like, that's dedication. That's serious dedication. But, you know, I rocked up to the queue. I had a book that I've got on the go at the moment that I was reading and enjoying. And then I didn't actually get to read the book because I was busy chatting to people in the queue. And it's just like, there's a whole sort of tatty fandom and movement that's out there, which is kind of cool. And I'm just like, they've done something. And I think it's the fact that it's two, for me, the reason why Tatty Divine means so much to me too is it's two amazing women.
And you know exactly who they are. Like,
you
know who runs Tatty Divine. Mm-hmm. You know what they look like. You know, mm-hmm, the one never changes her hairstyle. Like, mm-hmm, you know everything.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like I really understand who and what is behind Tatty Divine.
Yeah.
And the shop girls are so great.
Oh my God.
I'm so sad that we only have half of the twin dream team.
I know,
in Tatty
Emily
Divine
and
now.
Sean. Yeah. Oh my God. I saw them at the sample sale.
Were they both there?
They were both there together. It was a surprise because I saw Charlotte and then I saw Emily and I was like, oh, they're both here. They're both here together. And I hadn't seen them for a while. And I was able to share my good news with them about the book as well. And
they were so happy for you.
They were really pleased for me. And it's that thing that I don't think about, the fact that I've known them for so long as well. And, you know,
these are literally just like people that work in a shop that you visit.
Yeah.
And like, there aren't really many businesses where it's like you know, when you go into a shop, there's going to be like one of five people that, mm-hmm, you will recognize, and they will care about your life. And
yeah,
they will want to, like, you'll be someone that will brighten up their day.
Well, this is just it. You know, I'm blown away by the fact that I've known them for that long. And even to the point, you know, I had my sort of fangirl moment a few years ago when I went to their book launch that they did on how to make jewellery. And Rosie and Harriet knew who I was when I came in. And I was just
they
like,
are the founders of Tatty Divine, yes. For the people listening. Rosie and Harriet are the founders of Tatty Divine, and Emily and Charlotte are twins who at one time both worked in the Tatty Divine shops. Now only Charlotte works
there. I was just like, oh, right, okay, this is a bit weird that you know who I am or what have you. And it's just, you know, it's when I talk to the girls in the shop and they talk about the support that I've given them over the years of the business and what have you. And it's just like, it's two amazing enterprising women that founded this from like, what, a market stall in Portobello Road or something that's turned into this, and then having MBEs. It's like you're women to look up to in business and to aspire to and to respect as well for what you've created. And then what you've created with your, if you want to call it a retail empire in that sense as well, with the team that you have around you and the fact that women are travelling across Europe to come to your sample sales as well. You've done something right. And that means something to me. It sounds silly to say that, you know, acrylic jewellery means that much to me, but it's a huge part of who I am and
expressing your identity.
Yeah. I like loud, bright things, and you'll see that a lot when you look at pictures on the blog or the clothes that I'm wearing and what have you. There'll always be something loud and popping on me. And then sometimes I often think I might use that as a bit of a mask as well, because when I'm feeling quite nervous or anxious and what have you, it's like I need to have something that I can put on for performance, if that makes sense.
And like people, it gives people a reason to talk to you.
Yeah.
And then once they've been like, oh, that's a cool necklace, then it's like, okay, we've spoken now. Like I can sustain a conversation with this person.
Like a nice kind of icebreaker.
Well, the opposite of an icebreaker, mm-hmm. We are reaching the end of our chat.
Oh,
and time has flown.
I know,
so this
I
has
know.
Been really fun. But before we finish, mm-hmm. I have a few quick fire questions for you.
Oh, okay.
What is your all time favourite Tatty Divine piece?
No, Bethany, no.
Okay, I'll ask a different one, unless you have an answer.
Oh, do you know what? Oh my gosh. It's going to sound really cheesy, but it's my name necklace. It's the only name necklace that I've got by them that says Lady Velo. And I got that to celebrate the first anniversary of being back on a bike and being proud of the fact that I did it. So, and I cycled to go and collect it from Brick Lane as well. So that's my favourite bit, my Lady Velo necklace.
See, you did have an answer. If you went down the shop and you were going to buy some crisps, what crisps would you buy?
Prawn cocktail
Walkers.
Yeah.
Straight
all the time.
Pink bag,
because they're the best things for a crisp sandwich as well. So, yeah.
That's a little recipe for you there.
Little bit of French's mayonnaise. Not mayonnaise, mustard on it as well. So good. Dirty, but it's good.
What emoji best describes you?
Oh, the one that goes like this? The thinking one?
Yeah, the emoji.
Because you know what? Ian says to me as well, it's weird as we have conversations where we just send each other emojis. That's what we're like. But he always thinks of me and he says he wants to get a t-shirt done where it's just that emoji for me. But I'm always thinking about something or probably stressing myself out. So thinking emoji.
The thinking emoji. Mm-hmm. Final question. Is there anyone that you would like to hear me talk to? You don't have to think of an answer. But, you know, is there anyone that you know that I know that you're like, that'd be a cool person?
Do you know what? There is. And I'm going to make sure that I get this right. Candice Braithwaite is who you will need to speak to. She is absolutely amazing. She's one of the most inspirational black women that I follow on Instagram and Twitter. I get a lot of power from reading her posts. She's very, very honest as well. She's a fantastic mummy blogger as well, but she's like the kind, if I was a mother, this would be, you know, absolute resource and joy for me to be following this. I enjoy following her anyway, and I'm not a mum, but
whoa.
I really think you need to speak to her.
I've
been
scrolling through her Instagram while Jaws has been telling you. Jaws passed me the phone so that I can like check her out, and like, this is someone that I do not know, but I feel like would change my life.
Yeah.
So that's a great suggestion. I will get to know her, and maybe in a subsequent season,
yes!
She can be a guest. Thank you so much
brilliant.
For that suggestion.
No worries.
Jules, would you like to shout out your blog, your Twitter, your Instagram before we go?
Yeah. So if you want to follow me on Twitter, it's at Lady Velo. It's also at Lady Velo on Instagram. The blog is velocitygirl.co.uk. And if you want to follow my Facebook page as well, if you just search for Lady Velo, you'll find me.
Thank you so much for talking to me. It's been a joy.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
See you next time.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.